There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
This is Talking of Books with Isabel Abouhul, Annabelle Corton, and the rest of the Festival of Literature team.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good morning and big welcome to Talking of Books. I'm Annabelle Corton. I work for the Emirates Literature Foundation during the week, but I get to be here with you every Saturday from 10 to 1pm to chat about all the book things. So what's also exciting is that the Dubai Eye show today, the sweeper, actually matches who's on the show. Welcome, Isabel, finally.
Kiss, kiss over there. It's brilliant to be back. And I have to say a huge thank you and accolade to Annabelle for taking on this onerous task and doing it so brilliantly. I'm just delighted that you're doing it and bringing all your creative skills and butterfly wings to Talking of Books because it needed it.
Oh, thank you.
But we're here for my favourite show.
You're so excited about today.
Yeah, I am so excited. I can barely contain myself. It is the Man Booker shortlist. And I was just saying before we went on air, and I know we're going to have a huge row about it with James, James Mullen, who is a regular Booker shortlist panellist for us. I think it is the most exciting shortlist that we have had for a very long time. And I've been fortunate enough to read all of them. I haven't finished Lincoln on the Bardo. More about that later. But actually, I think the judges have done an amazing job of choosing. It's I know it's by chance. It's not that they are politically saying they've got three men and three women on the shortlist. Do you want to read out the shortlist, Annabelle, for our listeners?
Yeah, I do. Actually, do you have it in front of you?
I do. So we've got 4321 by Paul Auster, US. History of Wolves by Emily Fridland, US. Exit West by Mohsen Hamid, UK, Pakistan. Elmet by Fiona Mosley. I shouldn't have said it with quite so much enthusiasm. Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders, US. And Autumn by Ali Smith, UK. Two of the shortlists have been on previous Booker shortlists. Two of them are debut novels. So we've got Elmet and History of Wolves debut novels. And then we've got a very, very serious literary contender in Paul Auster with 4321. I think it's this is his book after 7 years of silence. And then George Saunders, who is a very well-known story writer, playwright, this is his first novel. So what a choice. What a choice.
Who do you think's going to win? Let's put that question out there right now.
I think Elmet's going to win by Fiona Mosley. If the public vote have their say, she is the front runner in terms of selling more copies than any other, with the exception of Autumn by Ali Smith. But that's been on sale for quite a long time. It's now in paperback. Elmet has been brought to people's attention because it's been longlisted and then shortlisted. And by word of mouth recommendation, it is up there. 603% increase in sales since it's been announced. And my goodness, I can't get it out of my head. I can't get the characters out of my head. It is just buzzing around. Every time I think about it, I want to know what they're up to today. So I'm not saying it's not without flaws, but my goodness, what a cracking start.
Well, that gives you a taste of what's coming up in our Booker discussion today. But if you're listening, remember that you can text in and we want to hear from you. So text into 4001 anytime you have comments, questions on anything that we're discussing. We're also going to have a few competitions coming up, so remember, text in the answers to those as well. And when we talk about the Booker Prize, it's not just Isabel and me in the studio. We do need to introduce everybody else here as well. So Yara, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, hi. So I've been on the show before. I work for the Literature Foundation team as well, heading up marketing, and have not read the whole list, as Isabel has, but a fair few.
Man?
Hi. I've been on the show a few times before. My name is Manjalal. I'm a journalist here with Khaleej Times, and I also have a YouTube channel where I talk about books and other bookish things. So I have read bits and pieces of the long list, but I've read some of the shortlist as well. So it's quite exciting yeah. stuff.
Before we talk about the shortlist and the long list as well, because I really want to talk about the ones that didn't make it to the shortlist, I have a literary moment for you.
Literary moment. Milestones in literary history.
So usually at this time of day, we do something called Young Reviewer, where we talk about children's books. Now, I am a grown-up child, so I am going to talk to you about Winnie the Pooh. It is relevant. I think there was an anniversary this week or something like that, but I don't need much of an excuse to talk about Winnie the Pooh. But I've got three fun facts about Winnie the Pooh, which Isabel probably knows all the answers to already. But here we go. So did you know that Winnie was based on a real bear called Winnipeg? Yara's nodding emphatically. So during World War One, a Canadian soldier named Harry Colburn made a pet of a black bear cub he bought from a hunter for $20. Named Winnipeg, or Winnie for short, the bear became his troop's mascot and later a resident of the London Zoological Gardens. And there she was an adored attraction rather, especially to a little boy who we all know called Christopher Robin Milne, son of A.A. Milne. In fact, the boy loved Winnie so much that he named his own teddy after her. So that's where Winnie gets her name from. And A.A. Milne was a soldier and a playwright before Winnie the Pooh dominated his legacy. And that's something that comes up in a film which I'm very much looking forward to see called Goodbye, Christopher Robin. I keep checking the release date for this, but it's still not there. And also, Winnie's Latin translation, get this, is the only Latin book to ever crack the New York Times bestseller list. So there's a random fact for you. It was called Winnie et le Pooh. The 1960 release was translated by Dr. Alexander Leonard, and it stayed on the coveted list for 20 weeks and ultimately demanded 21 printings and sold 125,000 copies.
In Latin?
In Latin.
Amazing. Yeah.
That's
amazing.
The power of Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah, that's great. And yes, Winnie the Pooh has touched and continues to touch so many children's lives. And there's a little thing in Winnie in one of the stories, poo sticks. So you have little sticks and you put them in a stream and then you run up onto a little bridge.
I've been there. I've actually done it at the actual bridge itself in Ashdown Forest.
Have you?
Yes.
I've done it in many places with my children and my grandchildren, that you find two twigs and then or more twigs and they throw them in and then they rush up and look which one's in the lead. Oh. And it's just that really stays with me, James. Mm. That sort of those kind of very simple things and the characters that A.A. Milne has created as in addition to Winnie the Pooh. You know, everyone has their favourites. So a great Winnie the Pooh moment. Mm.
I feel really bad right now because I've just noticed that James is behind the monitor and I didn't ask him to introduce himself. So would you mind, James?
I'm here. I was here last week and I've read five of the books, five of the Booker Prize books. And I think for listeners, I think the good news is that Isabel and I are probably going to have a row about this. So keep
yes.
listening.
Absolutely, yes. I think we've already hoisted our flags up, and James and I always disagree. Actually, yeah. on the Booker, it is one of the things, and I think he has a better track record than me on guessing the winner.
No, just recently, just the last 2 years, I've picked them.
Well, but I've only ever once been spot on. But what has happened? In terms of my choice, is that I choose the popular one. I choose the one that goes on to sell a million. And I think that's important. I think being able to give people a book that is accessible and readable and that will light up their imagination has to be the most important thing.
Let's take it back to basics for a very quick minute. For any listeners who aren't familiar with the Man Booker Prize, what exactly is the Man Booker Prize?
It's a prize. It's been going since about 1969, and they have different judges. They choose a whole panel of judges every year who are different, so it's not the same people, and they're chosen from the arts and from literature and from journalism, and they have to read the whole long list. In fact, they have to read a lot more than the long list. They will read, I think this year they might have read 106 books. And I only know that because I'm a trustee on the International Prize for Arabic Fiction, nothing to do with the judging side, but as a trustee. And they work, the Booker Foundation is part of that as well. When it was set up, they looked for, you know, an outstanding prize foundation, and so they work very closely. And they follow the same thing, that, you know, books will be submitted. There is, publishers are allowed to submit X number of books, each publisher. If they've had a winner before, they get to send in more. So they might have up to 106 books. Each judge gets their books delivered in whichever format they like, whether it's e-books or physical books, and then they together meet regularly, discuss the books and put together the long list. But one of the things they have to do is to read all submissions. Mm-hmm. So then we had the wonderful long list, which again, I think those amongst us on the panel today felt that some of the long list should have made the short list instead of books
yep.
that were on there. And the judges behind it also feel that. And I know over the years there's been stand-up rows, there's been walkouts, there's been threats of resignation, because people feel, you know, even if you're a judge, you feel very passionate about your book. And I can remember the year that Room by
Emma Donoghue
was on the shortlist, and one of the judges afterwards said that her 13-year-old daughter had read it and said, "I'm never going to speak to you again, Mummy, if you come home and tell me it's not going to win." And it didn't win, but it was the best selling.
Are they still on
year.
Speaking terms?
I can't remember the book that won. It's it's that kind of thing. So the judges feel as passionately as possible, and I do believe over the years that the move away from becoming where it was in the early days, I think a lot more academic and a lot more aimed at literary society. Mm. I think they now are looking at why we read. That has, for me, has been the biggest thing. What is it that we ask for in a book? What books are going to be life-changing for us? It's not about using long words or beautiful sentences. It is about the impact on great literature for us.
It's like the Oscars of the book world in a way.
Absolutely.
More on this when we come back. Keep your text coming into 4001. We really want to hear from you.
From Stephen King to Madhul Jaffrey, Anthony Horowitz to Kevin Kwan, this is Talking of Books.
On Dubai I 103.8.
If you're listening, you're in time for our special Booker show, where we're talking about the shortlist for the Man Booker Prize and also the long list, the ones that didn't quite make it to the list. So just to refresh, it's a literary prize awarded each year for the best original novel that's written in the English language. And it creates quite a lot of controversy. Who are we angry about for not, you know, making it to the shortlist? Which ones are we really frustrated didn't make it?
Well, for me, it was Home Fire. So Home Fire, written by Carmilla Shamsi, I think was treating a very difficult subject in a very subtle way. And so a lot of the novel is about kind of the rise of prejudice against immigrants and radicalization. And it's basically a story about family that's torn apart by one of the siblings' radicalization. And I loved it. I loved the way she dealt with that subject in a very, how do I put it?
I totally agree. I thought it was an absolutely wonderful book, and I really was convinced it would make the shortlist. It is based, it's a homage, isn't it, to Antigone,
correct.
A Greek tragedy. And again, the scenes towards the end of the book are just mind-blowing. You know, you really felt for the characters that were in the book.
It's probably the biggest surprise ending I've read in a long time.
Yes.
Which should make everybody want to read it, because you really don't see it coming.
But you love the characters along the way. Even if they're flawed, even if you don't agree with what they're doing, you believe it's believable. And I think she's done an amazing book. And again, I hope that more people will buy that. It didn't make the short list, but it was on the long list. And that is a huge stamp of approval. The judge of this year's Man Booker Prize 2017, Lola Baroness Young, said about the six books. She said, "With six unique and intrepid books that collectively push against the borders of convention, this year's shortlist has both acknowledges established authors and introduces new voices to the literary stage. Playful, sincere, unsettling, fierce. Here is a group of novels grown from tradition, but also radical and contemporary. the emotional, cultural, political and intellectual range of these books is remarkable, and the ways in which they challenge our thinking is a testament to the power of literature. No one could have said it better. And yes, they left off home fires, but you said that they took 6 hours to come from the long list to the short list. Are there any other books on the long list that you felt should have made it through, John?
I read Zadie Smith's Swing Time, and initially when I read it, I wasn't not enjoying it, but I sort of didn't figure out why it was such a big deal. I didn't really get the main character. I thought it was interesting. It's about it's a portrait of a friendship, two best friends who are both dancers. One of them is more talented than the other. Mm. And the main character is unnamed throughout the story, and we kind of see everything from her perspective, her tumultuous relationship with her mother and this best friend. But by the end of the book, it's one of those books that kind of sneaks up on you. Weeks after, I kept remembering different scenes and different ideas that were coming through. What I think was really interesting is I've never read a novel which describes dance in the way that this novel does and tells you a history of dance from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and how that relates to race relations today, especially in the UK. So I thought it was quite clever in that sense. And I think, I mean, it isn't without its flaws, but looking back at it in hindsight now, I think a lot of the flaws in the book were sort of put in there on purpose, like the main character, the fact that she's very reactionary. I think it's something to do with the bigger conversation on race in the UK. So I think it's one of those books that I was quite surprised that it didn't make it to the shortlist. And Zadie Smith, I think, as well, is a very interesting author. I think she's always very well-spoken and very articulate about her thoughts. So I think it's a novel that's very well planned in that sense. Mm.
And I enjoyed reading it. I love Zadie Smith's writing, but I felt it was based very much on her. I don't know whether it was because the protagonist who's telling the story, in the story, the mother is black and the father is white, which mirrors Zadie Smith. And she has huge issues with her mother. And she was not particularly likable.
The mother?
No, the mother. I thought the daughter, the main character, and she was so whiny. Everything she seemed to whine about. She was never satisfied with things. And her friend, she was entranced, wasn't she, with this friend who had in many ways a much more difficult life, but such a gutsy little girl. So I didn't expect it to make the. But the one I did, I thought should have been there instead of Lincoln on the Bardo, was The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. I think that is a grueling read. It's a devastating read, but it is a book that you, it's like a road accident that you can't help but look at in many, many ways. What he makes you see through his writing is horrific.
Yeah. I've read quite a few books on slavery, especially in the States, like Roots. I'm sure everyone's read Roots or Queen or The Color Purple. I mean, that's not really about slavery, but it deals with a lot of the same issues. And I felt like reading The Underground Railroad was different from all of those because he used a very clever, not a gimmick, but the Underground Railroad in the novel was actually referred to as a real railroad, which I thought was quite interesting and quite a cool, smart thing to do, I think, in the novel.
I thought that it did exist. I had to go and do my research afterwards to know that it was it was a euphemism for people that would help them escape. But, I was thinking, goodness, how did they manage to, you know, and then I thought, come on, I'm taken in so easily by things. I'll often believe what's in a book if I'm really engrossed in it. And then sometimes I have to say, it was like His Bloody Project by Graham McRae Burnett, who was on last year's shortlist. Many of us who read that thought it was based on real documents, and the whole thing was
Rob Mitchell, who was reviewing it. Yes. Rob thought exactly.
What was that one about?
It was about a murder. It was an amazing book. Again, you know, I would have
Isabel's
given it
favorite.
It was my favorite because it just completely. Everyone that I spoke to, including Rob Mitchell, we all believed it. We thought, well, this is obviously based on, and his name, the character in it was his surname was McRae. Gordon McRae Burnett. So we thought it was based on his sort of family history almost. It was so clever. And it went on to be an absolute bestseller, didn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, well, it was the one that we all recommended from the list last year.
Yeah. So that's well worth reading.
Yeah, it's very well researched as well. So if you don't know anything about that time period, I think it's interesting to read and get a lot of knowledge.
Yeah, and about the real, the downtrodden, how, you know, it was the sort of the serfdom that was still going on in many ways. And I think there is a huge interest in freedom and people's rights. And I think a lot of novels actually, you know, the Underground Railroad, His Bloody Project, Elmet, I think even History of Wolves raised that. Home Fire. And Mohsen Hamid's book have all got things about humanity and you know, what we feel are our God-given rights in many ways.
And about boundaries and ownership and freedom of movement and all those things.
And our understanding of ownership. You know, if you visit wonderful parts of the world like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, America, the First Nations, say in Canada, the Indigenous people of all of those had very different, their culture understood land and its bounty as there for everyone, and it was not this, oh, we'll put a fence around it and call it our own. And you know, I think it's this clash of civilizations when Europe was very much about, you know, we can own something, it is our right, and then other nations, other peoples who have a completely different, their culture respects land and its bounty in very different ways, and that's what I think Elmet, much of Elmet, is about ownership. You know, when I read it the second time, I was much more looking behind the writing. But we'll ask her when we speak to her.
Speaking about the Underground Railroad, we actually have a clip of Colson Whitehead talking about his book.
You know, I come away from a story like the Underground Railroad, in particular your story of the Underground Railroad, and I think of the courage it took to be a slave, to have the desire in your heart to be free and the will to try and the will to fight for that. And I think of that as, wow, that's the stock that I come from. Those are the people that are my people that had that stuff, that were able to withstand that. You write that, this story, and you come away more emboldened, more, you feel more powerful, more centered.
I think in thinking about what my ancestors went through for hundreds of years, it puts everything in scale. Like the stuff we complain about every day is so minuscule to just the fact of surviving till the end of the workday, so you can do it again the next day. And it was, you know, and it was a great culling. I mean, you had to survive the New World diseases, the brutality of the slave system, and it's a miracle that anyone has survived.
Colson Whitehead talking about the Underground Railroad. Something that I found online was a Telegraph article, which some of which you won't agree with, Isabel.
That's fine.
And it's basically about the fact that certain books not making it to the shortlist is an oversight on the part of the judges. We know, though, that they've sat in a room for 6 hours deliberating over this, and they haven't taken the decision lightly. One of the things he says is perhaps the problem, as ever with the Booker, was that the judges had an agenda that was not purely literary. Look at the politely balanced shortlist: 3 Britons, 3 Americans, 3 men, and 3 women. He says there's also a Brexit tinge to the novels on the list, an attempt to look beyond the capital. Neither Zadie Swift's Swing Time, which Mum was talking about, a nostalgic evocation of 80s North London, and Kamala Shamsi's Home Fire, about a young British Muslim from West London joining IS, made it off the long list. Instead, we find Ali Smith's Autumn, written on the fly last year in response to the EU referendum. So what were the judges thinking? Clearly, they've tried to favour novels that take a narrative gamble, that have been overlooked by other prizes, and that examine Britain beyond the metropolis. Do you agree with this?
No, I don't. Just because I actually know the people behind the Booker Foundation, and their remit to judges is there is no agenda. There is no agenda. People find that hard to believe. But when they appoint the judges, the trustees take a step back and they have nothing. They do not say, oh, come on, you've got to come up with this, that and the other. They have 106 or 180 or 120 books to read, and it's their choice. And it's publishers who submit the books. They are free to submit any book they want. So it may be, you know, from the bigger publishers to Smaller publishers, they would be. But every book that is published in UK within that time frame is eligible to enter the Booker.
Do you not think that the point about choosing books that haven't won prizes is something that's happened here as well?
No, I don't. I just think it's that they would have had, you know, they. There's the chair and there's the judges, and they will all fight. They will have their favourite. I'm sure every judge had their favourite, and they will fight for that inclusion, and they will argue about the reason for it. I mean, 6 hours is a long time to be sat arguing about a shortlist, and I don't think they ever agree. And I don't think there will be a unanimous vote on who wins either. I think, again, but it will be a majority vote. That's all you can ask for.
It'd be fun to be a fly on the wall in that conversation, wouldn't it?
I think it makes for an interesting shortlist, though. I mean, the fact that there are debut novels on there. Mm. So there you have the kind of Davids and the Goliaths. And I think that makes, whether it was intentional or not... Mm.
I don't think it was. I honestly do not think it was. I think that like when I read Elmet, when you read Elmet, or when we read History of Wolves, I was stunned. They were both so original. And I just thought, oh, my goodness, this is fantastic to have that highlighted as a reader, to find a book that is different. Now, you know, this one, Lincoln and the Bardic, is definitely creative. And maybe if we are not given those books, we're going to be the poorer for it. We're going to take a short break.
We are. More on this when we come back. Keep your text coming in to 4001.
From John Ronson to James Dashner, Jane Austen to Zadie Smith, this is Talking of Books on Dubai
I 103.8.
Welcome back. If you've just tuned in, you're in time for our big question today, which is, who will win the Man Booker Prize this year?
The big question.
Well done, Elaine. Thank you. Sorry for interrupting. Before we get on to that, we do have some random book news to share with you.
Book news, your latest literary roundup.
Got it right that time. Okay, so Tom Hanks' Reading Habits is the book news today. So he's releasing a short story collection on the same day that the Booker Prize winner is being announced. It's called Uncommon Type, Some Stories. And basically, I'm not going to tell you about the stories. If you're interested, you can go and find out about them. But I was interested in Tom Hanks' Reading Habits. He is an avid collector of vintage typewriters and owns over 100 of them. I didn't know that. And I was interested as to how he makes his book choices. He says, I only care about the subject, what do I know and how little do I know, and is there more I want to know? That and certain authors who never let me down. He mentions people like Dave Eggers, Bill Bryson, etc. And then he says, I stack up the books, 3 columns, 6 or 8 books at a time, and just wear that pile down. And when someone tells me they finally read a book they could never crack, I take a whack out of a sense of a challenge. And that's how I finally read Moby Dick, the book everyone pretends to know. Which I'm reminded of our session this year at the festival, the year of Reading Dangerously, which is all about the books that people pretend to have read, like War and Peace. Have you ever done that? Anybody in the studio ever pretended to have read anything?
I have not for a long time, but when I was young, I pretended to be much more literary than I actually was, and I got caught out. So
how did you get caught out?
What book was it? Well, because the person I was speaking to was extremely literary and then asked a question, and it was obvious I hadn't read it. You cannot get away with that. And so it was a good lesson, because then I never did it again. I'd much rather say I hadn't read a book. And what irritates me is people who read reviews. A lot of people read reviews. Now, if you've read a review of any of these books on the Man Booker shortlist, you have no idea what the book's about. You'd have no idea what the book's about. You've got to read the book. You have got to read the book to have an understanding.
You know, it was Mark Twain's line about a classic, definition of a classic. Classic is a book that everybody wants to have read, but nobody wants to read.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Something that you might like as well, Isabel, is he talks about the fact that he starred in many movie adaptations, and he had to kind of pick his favourite source material novels for those. He said The Green Mile was a perfect adaptation from Stephen King. I think we can all agree on that. The screenplay folded into the six novellas hand in glove. Forrest Gump was a high wire interpretation of Winston Groom's book. And Cloud Atlas, we were talking about that the other day. He said, for me, reached the High Country, so different in form and function from the Mitchell book, but exact in every detail nonetheless. Did you anybody see the film adaptation of that?
I couldn't bear to see it. I loved the book so much. That should have won the Book of the Year. It was there. I mean, it was the most incredible book, and I just could not see how that could be a film, so I would not see the film.
Do you remember what won instead?
No, well, that's the thing, you don't. You see, you remember your favorite. You just remember your favorite. It certainly didn't go on to be the book that Cloud Atlas has been, and it's a classic, and I'm sure is something that will be, you know, as relevant 100 years from now as it was when David Mitchell wrote it.
One last thing he says is he avoids genres like murder and conspiracy. Novels of murder and conspiracy he doesn't like, didn't know that. And he likes to read paper, and he likes to read a book one at a time, which I don't think I've ever managed to do in my life.
Mm, interesting, though.
Yeah.
Now, there is definitely I think, a good way is to read one book at a time. I know we don't, but actually I have two books of fiction going at the same time, I sometimes get muddled about who's in what book.
Yeah, I can only do fiction and non-fiction at the same time.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a good thing, to do fiction and non-fiction, because you just start to, you know, particularly when you're reading at bedtime and you're sort of drifting off, you wake up and then you can't remember which book you were in, which character you love. So I think it's
I have about eight on the go at the time. It's like having schizophrenia, I suppose. So we were talking about the long list and the ones that didn't make it to the short list. One of those that we haven't talked about is Arundhati Roy's The Ministry of Utmost Happiness. I think the main fact that everybody finds interesting about this is it's her first novel in, was it 20 years?
Yeah, very long time.
Was it The God of Small Things was the first one that she wrote?
Yeah. Mm. So, and that won the Booker.
That won the Booker. Mm-hmm. Who has read that one?
So I've read that, and I read it based on the fact that she had won the Man Booker for The God of Small Things, and I heard so many brilliant things about it, and I follow her on social media, and I think she's quite an interesting person. So when I read the book, it's very beautifully written, it's complex, it's long, it's epic, but there's no actual story. This is what I found really frustrating, and I think her writing is maybe too complex or too beautiful. It went into too many tangents. I had to find out the story, the background of a random character who does nothing for the plot, which I find quite distracting because I just kind of want to get into the story. So that was something I really took issue with. And the other fact is I think halfway through the book, and I looked back and I was like, what actually happened? I have no idea what's happening, where we're heading, why we keep introducing new characters, and it kept switching from first person to third person, and we keep moving back in time and it's not very succinct in that sense. So I always found myself quite confused. So if you love complex, beautiful writing and not really into story, then this is definitely the book for you.
But God of Small Things, I felt, was very manicured, and it was too embroidered and too many beautiful, you'd read a sentence and think, oh, that's beautiful. You shouldn't ever think that in a book. You should be so engaged with the book and its characters that you don't notice it. It's sort of painting this wonderful picture. And so it was a wonderful book, The God of Small Things, but I did feel it was too played about with. And for me, she's, you know, I mean, I read a sample on my Kindle, so I downloaded all the long list onto my Kindle, which is a great thing. You can do that for free. And then I read them all, and that's when I fell in love with Elmet and History of Wolves, and immediately then bought the book.
I will say one thing, though, that I think it's a shame. I felt like it was a missed opportunity because she deals with some really interesting political issues that are happening in India in the 80s and 90s, and I don't know much about Indian politics. So I thought, yep, I'm going to learn a little bit something here, but it was, again, a missed opportunity because she focused so much on the flowery, ornate writing as opposed to the actual issues and the characters.
Mm. Yeah. And it didn't make the shortlist.
No,
so good on the Booker judges there.
I feel like we've really sold the book in time for me to do this competition, but I'm going to go with it anyway. So The Ministry of Utmost Happiness by Arundhati Roy. If anybody would like to win a copy of this novel, please
I'm sure they'll love it.
Please text in with your name to 4001 and the answer to this very important question: what book makes you happy? So yeah, if you'd like to win a copy of that, please do text in. And don't listen to Isabel.
Yeah. It would be, if I wanted to find out what people loved most, it would be what book makes you sad.
Yeah?
That is a sign for me of a great book.
That's a great question, actually.
Yeah. Well, if a book makes me cry, then it's definitely got a tick from me.
What book on the long list, then, made you cry?
Helmet made me cry. History of Wolves made me cry. Home Fire on the long list made me cry.
Yeah.
Lincoln in the Bardo did not make me cry, and it didn't even make me laugh. So,
Exit West made me tear up, and
yes, there were parts of it. Well, yeah. It was so sad that they fell out of love. I mean, that was for me the sad bit, and you could, you see that they grew out of each other.
Is that a spoiler?
Yeah.
Oh no!
Spoiler alert.
No.
If you've not read it.
No. Oh, man. Okay. Oh, well. One thing I do want to bring to the table is another discussion point about the Booker Prize, and that's the whole American argument. Now, for anybody who's not aware, the Man Booker Prize didn't always used to be called the Man Booker Prize. One question that often gets asked as well is it just for men? And it's not. The Man Group is basically the sponsor of the prize, and up until a few years ago, it only used to be open to certain nationalities, didn't it?
It was UK. It was any book published in UK. The author had to be from the UK, Ireland,
or the Commonwealth.
Yeah. So that was still quite a big thing. But then 4 years ago, they opened it up to any book in English and from anywhere in the world, as long as it's published in UK within the time frame.
I want to know what you think of this. So somebody has made a point that they've called the article, the Man Booker shortlist is as American as half an apple pie this year. So the decision to include American writers has some very real implications, and British authors like Julian Barnes, who called the decision straightforwardly daft, that's a quote, A.S. Byatt and several others did not hesitate to make their thoughts known. Barnes commented at the time that the Americans have got enough prizes of their own. The idea of the Booker being Britain, Ireland, the old Commonwealth countries, and new voices in English from around the world gave it a particular character and meant it could bring on writers. If you also include Americans and get a couple of heavy hitters, then the unknown Canadian novelist hasn't got a chance.
Oh. Get lost, basically. I thought that's sour grapes. I mean, in this global age, by sort of they haven't just opened it up to America. They haven't said all the other countries in the world that were before not eligible, you can't be part of it. They are also there. I think, we've got two debut novelists on it, so I really don't think it's a valid point.
And if they had excluded Americans, then Paul Beattie wouldn't have won last year, which would have been a complete disaster.
Oh, it would have been wonderful.
that's another of our Barneys, yes, actually. Yeah. I mean, that particular book, which is a Marmite book, either you love or you hate it, but I thought it was a fantastic piece of
literature. And you were right. I mean, the judges chose that. I chose this bloody project.
Yeah.
More fisticuffs and Marmite when we come back. Text in your favourite book, the one that makes you happy, to 4001. We keep getting those texts. We'll be back shortly.
From John Ronson to James Dashner, Jane Austen to Zadie Smith, this is Talking of Books on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Welcome back to Talking of Books, and all kudos to Annabelle for putting together such a brilliant show with so many different interesting points. We're finding it really hard to stay on track here, and she's finding it quite hard to keep us in order. But James and I have read one of this year's Man Booker shortlisted books, a novel by Paul Auster. 4321 is the title, and it's nearly 1,000 pages long.
1,057.
Is it okay?
Not
okay.
That you're counting.
I was reading this on my Kindle, and I could not understand after 2 weeks why I'd only got to 25%. And then because you don't know on a Kindle how many pages it is, and I was just thinking, have I gone back to square one? And again, because of the way the book is, quite easily I could have done. So tell our listeners, James, about Paul Auster's book and what you think about it.
Well, Paul Auster's book, the first thing you need to have, as Isabel has indicated, is stamina. 1,057. This is a big American book. It's a book by Paul Auster, who is a very well-established author. and has you know, is very well thought of. And the book itself is you get in, even the first five pages of this, you become aware that this is a big American book, because you've got lots of characters thrown at you. And you have this particular character, the Ferguson character. And it's basically four lives, isn't it? That's what we've got here, Isabel.
And well, it's four paths.
Four paths.
Four paths. And depending on an incident or a happening, four different paths, but taken by most of the same characters.
Yeah, so for anybody who's seen the movie Sliding Doors,
yeah,
where you have two versions of it, think about that. That's the sort of premise that you have with this book. And it's a sort of Dickensian book. And in fact, during parts of the novel, he references Dickens. You can see that Paul Auster is a big fan of Dickens. So it's as I say, it's part of this. I don't know, is it this massive pressure amongst American novelists to write the big American novel?
Mm. He's certainly written the big American novel. There is no doubt about that. But I love his writing. I have to say, it's very engaging. I love the characterizations. I could easily have been my favorite book, except I do not need four versions. I don't need four versions.
Yeah, I mean, he's a very confident. As you say, Isabel. I mean, he's a very confident. He's a tremendous writer and a tremendous stylist. You feel immediately when you get into this book, you feel comfortable that you're in the presence of somebody who knows how to write, and who knows how to create characters, who knows how to paint pictures. And I think that's one of the great things about this book, is that when you're in it, you are immersed in it. It is an immersive book.
And the characters are fully believable. And it starts off with Ferguson, but not Ferguson, but the sort of the grandfather or great-grandfather even of Ferguson, the main character. He arrives at the island. Is it Ellis Island, where all immigrants in the 1800s? And he can't speak American. And someone in the... he can't speak American. He can't even speak English.
I can't either.
Someone in the queue said, oh, you should say your name's Rockefeller. Yes. And so he gets to the front line and he'd forgotten what... But he can't speak English. So he says, Ich haben vergessen. And so he gets called Ichbod Ferguson. And I thought that was so good. And that's the Ferguson that goes through the...
It's funny, have you been to Ellis Island at all?
Yes, I did when we went.
And what's interesting about that is that sort of story, when you're there in the museum, which is one of the most interesting museums I've ever been into, actually.
It's incredible.
But that actually happens a lot. People got to the queue, the front of the queue, and they, wherever they were from, whether it was from Sweden or from England or from Ireland, wherever, and the guy would just write down what he heard them saying their name, and that was then their name. So you often wonder about American names. They look like weird versions of English or Norwegian or Swedish names.
Ferguson from Ich haben vergessen is actually, he must have just thought he's got quite a Scottish accent or something like that, because there were no documentations, and as you said, you then became that person. And so I thought, and the story is full of history, full of politics, full of love, full of relationships, full of family fallings out. But I cannot deal with four versions. I really can't. You know, maybe two versions.
Yeah. Why do you think he chose four? I mean, does anybody know why four? Exactly right. I mean, I would agree with you. I would say, well, why don't you just go with two?
Yeah.
The sliding doors analogy.
But four, you're right. Because
he's covering
so much actually politics and American history within that, or world history within that time. And it's also quite confusing because his father doesn't get killed. His father does get killed. His uncle does win the bet on the
World Series.
And then he doesn't. He gambles all his money on that. And all these. And I'm thinking now, I found it just too much to actually get my head around, and the different things. And I was listening to an interview with him, because I really do rate his writing. And I would like to go back and perhaps read it again when I'm on a, you know, a 15-hour plane journey twice or three times
island.
Or whatever. Well, it's the only time when I will sit down and continue to read. And I think you need to continue to read this because putting it down and picking it up, you lose which
what,
version
characters
you're in.
And you yeah. lose, yes.
Yes,
yeah, absolutely.
And I love the character of Rose, his mother, and the photographer. But he said that an event happened to him when he was about 14, Paul Auster. He'd gone to a summer camp. The Americans are very keen on sending their children away for these summer camps. And he'd gone to this summer camp every year. And they were out in a field, and the boy in front of him was climbing through a barbed wire fence when lightning struck and killed him. And Paul was with him and stayed with him for an hour or more, trying to keep him warm and things like that. And this has made such an impact, a life-changing impact on him. And this happens, doesn't it? It happens in one of the characters, you know, one of the four Fergusons. It happens to him. And so I think he's taken a lot of his life and his opinions and put it into this book.
Absolutely, and yeah, as you say, I mean, he's spoken about this, and he covers some of the major issues in American life. So you've got the assassination of JFK, you've got the My Lai massacre, and you've got all of these issues are sort of woven within the book. But it's funny, isn't it? Because I just think, you know, you've got Jonathan Franzen, you've got Philip Roth, you've got these American authors that write these big books about important things that happen in America, and you just wonder. I mean, why couldn't some of this happen outside America? Mm. So one of the Fergusons, for instance, not be in America? Could they not just travel, I don't know, go to Mexico perhaps, you know? I don't know. It's one of those things you're reading, you know, these big American books, and maybe the time that we're in is this inward-looking aspect of American fiction that I find a little bit tiring, actually. Mm.
Very insular. I mean, one of them, he does, in fairness, he's obsessed, Paul Auster's obsessed with Paris. And so one of the Fergusons actually spends life in Paris. But I just wished he'd just written one or maximum two, because it is an amazing story, but it's too complex and it's too... Then you sort of start to disengage with what he's trying to
Agreed.
Tell you.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.